The police arrested 47 people, including several journalists. 10 reporters have been arrested or detained in the last week and a half of covering the fast-moving events in Ferguson. The ACLU went to court last week to ensure that reporters be allowed to cover the demonstrations after two journalists, one working for the Washington Post and the other for Huffington Post, were arrested and later released. Reporters have described being caught in the middle of violent confrontations between the police and demonstrators. They've complained about being kept away from stories they want to cover by law enforcement. The protests in Ferguson have been a ratings bonanza for cable news, devoting 24/7 coverage. So today on Radio Times, has the media, including broadcast, print, and digital, effectively and responsibly informed the public about events in Ferguson and the important issues they raise? And we have two guests who have joined us in this hour of Radio Times. Paul Farhi is media reporter for the Washington Post. Paul, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much.
Also with us is James Peterson, Director of Africana Studies, Associate Professor of English at Lehigh University, and he's got a new book coming out in just a couple of weeks called The Hip-Hop Underground and African-American Culture. And James Peterson, nice to have you with us Radio Times as well. Paul, if I can begin with you, and I've read some of the tweets from Wesley Lowery, who's a Washington Post reporter who was in Ferguson, and I'm also sort of curious about the kind of, I guess, preparation that journalists have had to cover this very fast-moving and, in certain ways, dangerous story.
That's right. I mean, it's effectively a war zone. I mean, we wouldn't necessarily call it that, but the Washington Post, my publication, outfitted its reporters with gas masks, bought at a chain hardware store on Monday. We've got flak jackets, so we've got helmets. You know, the chance of injury, the chance of something very bad happening, you're walking into a chaotic situation. So it's not like covering the city council meeting.
Well, in fact, one of your reporters, Amy Nelson, quoted as saying, "This is my most dangerous assignment," and went on to say, "And I'm having a great time."
Yeah, I think there's a certain adrenaline rush. War correspondents are war correspondents because the story matters a lot, but they're war correspondents because it is so exciting to be in the middle of action like that, and you're defying death in a way. I don't want to be too extreme about this. It's not necessarily quite the same situation with bombs going off and what have you, but there is risk, and I do think some reporters feel like that is an important consideration to be in the middle of that kind of story.
Where are you getting your news, James?
I'm getting a lot of news from Twitter. Obviously, I'm watching MSNBC. That's the network that I'm affiliated with, so I watch that coverage. I think we have some great people on the ground. I think Tremaine Lee's reporting and coverage has been amazing. I've also been following Lowery on Twitter, because he, his on-the-ground sense of things gives us a better perspective. One of the things I think that's most challenging about this is the no-fly zone and what that means in terms of reporting, because we're not getting a good perspective on how the police are moving, or how
you mean
literally looking down. We don't have that view, and I think when you're watching it on TV, you're only getting this. And Rachel Maddow talked about this very eloquently. We're only getting this kind of two-dimensional perspective, and we really need a different focalization of this entire process. Some of the reporters on the ground are able to give us some of that, but I'd love to have pictures from aerial views of what's happening right there on that main strip in Ferguson.
And why do you think this has become a national, even an international story, which it has?
It's a big international story. I've fielded more international requests over the last week and a half or so than I have in my entire career.
Really?
as a media person, yes. And so it's definitely an international story. I think the reason why it's a national story is different and distinct from why it's an international story. So it's a national story because people are beginning to realize that these separate sort of iterations of unjustifiable murders of black boys or black girls or young people of color, period, they're no longer isolated incidents. So people can now, between Eric Garner, the young man out in Los Angeles, and Michael Brown, those things happened in fast succession. And I think people can see, wait, this is a structural, systematic problem. This is not just some rogue vigilante killing someone or just some police officer who's making a grave mistake. This is actually a problem that is how people see other people. And I think that is catching hold a bit for the national story. But internationally, what the folk outside of America see is, like, wait a second, America, the streets of America looks just like all these other places that they claim that they're not. And so the irony of that and maybe the hypocrisy of that is what makes it compelling at the international level.
Let me go back to you, Paul. And I think there are many stories coming out of Ferguson. And, some of them have to do with, clearly the death of an 18-year-old unarmed teenager by a police officer. That is one story. Another story that seems to be growing out of this is how did these police departments get all this military equipment? What do you see as first of all, why it's so important and why it's so compelling and what the various narratives are?
Yes, there are lots of narratives. And, what's so great, if that's the word, about this story is it's really a crucible for American society. It's a story about police action. It's a story about poverty. It's a story about people who feel disenfranchised from our system. It exposes so many elements about American society, and violence is ultimately just one part of it. It's the thing that captures the television cameras and draws the reporters to the scene. But again, this is the millionth iteration of the kind of story that exposes the fault lines in our society.
Does that make it a hard story, Paul, though, to cover because it is so loaded, if I can use that word?
No, I think reporters are drawn to those kinds of stories because they contain all the elements of great stories. They challenge the officials to respond. They make us examine our values. They make us confront our pathologies. They make us really reflect on ourselves as a society and as a nation.
To you, James, we touched on this earlier, the fact that the Pentagon, we learned, sort of like with Trayvon Martin, we learn about stand your ground laws. Mm-hmm. And I think with this story, one of the things we're learning is this program from the Pentagon where they away excess military equipment to police departments.
Those of us who have been following closely, we knew that this was happening. And if you remember the pictures or the images from the Boston Marathon bombing, some of us at that time were asking, like, whoa, wait a second.
It's a tank, right?
There's tanks in the streets of Boston. Now, here's this. It's so interesting because the tension between security and freedom, I think people were willing to sort of let those images go because they thought it was in the interest of the security and securing Boston in that horrible tragedy in that moment. Now when you see the confrontation between that kind of militarized police force and a community that is really struggling with the questions of, what's the value of black life? That's the depth of the question. What value does this society place on black life? And so to try to deal with that in the context of a militarized police force is a very complicated thing, and that's why we've seen some of these things stretch out over the last few days.
Well,
I was going to say, I'd also say that in the name of protecting the people and in the name of protecting the police officers, you wonder if that kind of display of force does exactly the opposite. It incites and inspires the kind of reaction that we've seen over the last week and a half, 2 weeks.
I'm convinced that it does. I'm convinced that it does. Now, you can't account for all of the skirmishes and things from this, but I'm convinced of two things. One, that when you have that show of force, it actually attracts some of those outside folks. Remember, there are some people who are just interested in anarchy, people who are interested in challenging the state because they realize the state's oppressive in many ways, and that show of force by the state is going to attract those kinds of folk. And then for the people who are, again, wrestling with this deep question of, does the state acknowledge any value for black life? To have the state physically oppressing you is provoking. It's a provocation. It is.
Well, and going back to you, Paul, and just thinking of those, the early on images, and for people who weren't aware that this is what police departments were doing, and we have the image of a police department in camo with
why are they wearing camouflage in Ferguson?
Well, and holding and pointing assault weapons at people who were protesting on the street. I think that is a lasting and powerful image.
Yes, it certainly is. And I'll add one more element. I am old enough to remember the urban riots of the 1960s. I was a little kid, but the calling out of the National Guard is itself a kind of provocation, because now you're putting a militarized force into a community situation, and that is its own escalation, and that's its own kind of provocation when you're rolling Humvees down the street this way. So, you know, among the elements that I think are going to be addressed and dissected after the fact was the response proper, and was it too heavy-handed? I think there's pretty good evidence that it might well have been.
Let me go back to you, James, because MSNBC and other cable channels are pretty much devoting all the airtime to what's happening in Ferguson. And I often wonder when a network decides to devote that much time, what isn't getting covered? I mean, there are all sorts of things that are going on across the world. But it is a commitment that has been made to cover this story.
It is, and I think what's been acknowledged by the cable news networks, and I think all of them have to acknowledge this in one way, is that this, what's different about Ferguson than some of the other stories that we've covered, is the people's response. The angst and anger and the energy that the people feel right there on the ground. That is a part of the story. Why do they feel that way? Again, because they're questioning what's the value of black life. It's a deep existential question that has not been answered. If a fraction of the energy that's been put into law enforcement and containment was actually put into transparency of the process, for example, if we had an incident report, if there was a county autopsy report, if the people had faith in the district attorney and the prosecutors, if any of those things were in place, you might have less tension. None of those things are, and so there is, you know, there's a lot of tension there, and that draws the media. Now, there are many stories that get lost or not covered when cable news is the focal point through which you're experiencing something. That's why we need Twitter. That's why we need the Washington Post. That's why I want that helicopter to give us that different perspective.
That aerial view.
We need multiple perspectives in order to capture the nuances of this story.
Yeah, Paul, I'd be curious about what you make of that pretty much 24/7 coverage.
Well, there is a theory in media studies about the self-perpetuation of a story as a result of the story getting attention. And I do think there's probably some of that here. The more you focus on this, the more people see this, the more some elements want to join in, and it perpetuates the story. It perpetuates the action on the streets. And I think James' point about having a helicopter shot would be very interesting, because we'd have a better sense of the scope of this. When you see these television pictures, you see chaos, you see movement, you see a lot of drama, but you don't really have a sense of quantity. You don't know how many people are actually involved there. And I'd be curious myself. A lot of the news reports do not tell you there were X number of people on the streets. Is it a lot? Is it a little? I'm actually a bit mystified about that. A helicopter shot would tell us just how large these demonstrations and protests are.
And we're almost having a break. I mean, is there a no-fly zone, or just
there
has
is.
A
hat? There is. No-fly zone was renewed, actually. And again, without that perspective, I think we're also missing a big piece of the story, which is how is the police moving? How is that National Guard moving? To me, that's really, really important here.
We are talking about the media coverage of Ferguson, Missouri, talking with James Peterson and Paul Farhi, and we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. Stay with us. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
The Barnes Foundation supports WHYY. The World is an Apple. The Still Lifes of Paul Cézanne is in its final weeks. Along with the 69 Cézannes in the permanent collection, this exhibition shows how Cézanne revolutionized the still life genre, making fruits, flowers, and skulls vibrate with color and pulse with life, and demonstrates why he was hailed as the father of modern art, now through September 22nd. Tickets available daily on-site or at barnesfoundation.org or 215-278-7200.
This week on This American Life, Mandy's mother-in-law has Alzheimer's, and sometimes she sees things that aren't there, like monkeys out the window. The family used to argue with her and say, you know, there aren't any monkeys. And then they learned she did better if they just played along. Said things like,
"It's pretty early in the season for monkeys."
Or,
"If you see one again, we should try and capture it to have in the house."
Using improv skills with your aging parents this week.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY. I'm Jeremy Hobson. Some of China's wealthiest are starting to sell their homes amid a crackdown on corruption.
Stories of officials who are essentially giant landlords are legion in China. Last year, there was a political leader who was caught in Inner Mongolia. He had 33 properties in China and a house in Canada.
So what does a sell-off mean for China's economy? That's next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Paul Farhi. He's media reporter for The Washington Post. Also with James Peterson, director of Africana Studies at Lehigh University, about the media coverage of Ferguson, Missouri. And on cable, some of the cable channels, it's pretty much been 24/7. And we want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499 about your takeaway as you watch events there in Ferguson, Missouri. We did a show yesterday, and I want to talk about this just briefly, but I want to acknowledge it was an imperfect show. It wasn't exactly what we wanted to do, but we were trying to get a local perspective here in Philadelphia, a local law enforcement perspective on what was going on in Ferguson, to see, are there lessons learned that law enforcement could use here in Philly or perhaps even in Pennsylvania? And people were very angry at us. For instance, we had three white guests. I'm a white woman. And we were, in certain ways, explaining the militarization of the police, not criticizing it probably as much as I thought we were going to do.
Right.
I'm going on in here just to say that it's, when you're covering something from afar,
it's complicated.
And there are all these moving pieces.
Yes.
And you try to pre-interview people to get the people that you want. It sometimes is imperfect what you go on the air with.
Yes, and I would say that producing segments and around complicated issues like this is always an imperfect process. And that many of us have made mistakes. But let me just, I want to just analyze this a little bit. Through cable news, we've seen probably too much coverage of law enforcement. We're seeing too much of the story through the eyes of law enforcement. When the president speaks, he's talking more about law enforcement and security than he is about the issue. And so people's frustration, Marty, is that it seems like even though there is all this coverage, we're not talking about what the real problem is. Remember, Michael Brown was left dead in the street for 4 hours in that community. It terrorized that community. People's connection to that is understanding that that could happen almost anywhere. And so while the militarization of the police for someone like me is a very important issue, it really is. It's connected to this because it's about the people who are going to suffer from that militarization the most. That's black, brown, and poor people. But your audience, Marty, they want to hear you talk about the racial challenges and the racial issues because they know where your heart is. They do. And so for a lot of us, it has been somewhat frustrating that there's been a law enforcement focalization of the coverage, and people want to talk about, listen, does the state value black life?
Well, let me segue to you, Paul, and I even wonder, you know, when there are events that are happening in other parts of the country, whether local media does a better job. I mean, we know that a lot of kind of well-known news people helicopter in or fly in and cover events for better or for worse. But I'm thinking if this were happening in Philadelphia, I mean, I feel like local news would know who to call.
Yeah, that's always the case. Local news being local, they have much more connection in the community. They know the players better. Not to say the national media can't catch up, but if you look at the St. Louis Post-Dispatch coverage, it's extensive, it's detailed. They know people, they know where to go. A lot of people end up following, that is to say, reading that coverage and following their lead. But, you know, that's the value of local media, right. And that's why the deterioration of the local media, I might add, is very, very distressing development. Yeah.
What do you make of Captain Johnson? This is to you, James Peterson. He's an interesting person. He talks to the press a lot. He's arresting the press as well.
Yes. Well, Captain Johnson, I think he's a great guy, a great state trooper. He has a terrible job right now. And I think for a lot of black folk who are watching, this is very, very difficult to not see him as a sort of pacifying intermediary. And you get the sense sometimes that he's not really in charge, that they've just said that he's in charge to try to defuse the situation. But he's not going to take any advice from me. But what I would recommend to Captain Johnson, especially because it looks like he's going to be in front of those cameras a lot, is that they just the shot with him in front of a bunch of white officers is probably not the best shot to have. And I know they don't want to play that PR game, but that's just the reality of it. Number two, you know, he's got to understand that there's the possibility that some of the people who are acting out in their eyes, some of the people who are violent or throwing things, that they're not doing it just for crazy reasons, that they're doing it to express the frustration and the anger about this burning question as to whether or not the state values and respects black life.
To you, Paul, and one of the things that Captain Johnson has said, and a number, I think it's about 10 reporters have been arrested. They've been later released, but nonetheless arrested. He's saying, you know, in a crowd like this, we can't always tell who's a demonstrator, who's a criminal there to, you know, with bad intent, and who is a journalist. How do you, does that hold water for you?
I actually disagree. I think you can tell. They're wearing credentials. They're carrying cameras. They're not violent. They're perhaps in the way. That might be a reasonable argument for the cops to make. But not being able to tell who they are, I don't think that's really a legit. And any professional reporter makes sure that they make known that they are with a news organization. The Washington Post, for instance, distributed these flak vests that you've probably seen in war zones. They say right across the front of them, press. It'd be very hard for any cop not to realize that someone is from a news organization wearing one of those.
Anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, the nuances of policing and community policing and handling large groups at civic times of civic unrest has completely been lost in the sauce here. That's why, again, it is important for us to really closely evaluate what the police actions have been, not just the obscuring of information and leaking of crazy information. That stuff is the ethics of that is, you know, unconscionable. But in terms of what they're doing logistically on the ground, we have to pay very close attention to this, because if their response, when they make a mistake, and I think at the bare minimum here, we can concede that Officer Wilson made a mistake. If their response is militarized force and containment and arresting journalists and tear gassing American citizens, I mean, that I think needs to be held up to quite a bit of scrutiny.
Yeah, go ahead, Paul. Sounds like you want to say something.
I was going to say, at the risk of being contrary,
no.
I don't think
the whole
story has been told here, and I don't think we've really gotten a very good account from Officer Wilson, certainly, but certainly from the Ferguson police force, from the county officials.
Then they should release it, then. They should release their incident report.
They absolutely should. They absolutely should. They're doing themselves irreparable harm by the very slow release of and selective release of information. Get it all out there. In any crisis, that's the basic thing. Get all the information out there and get it out there fast. And what they have done is make this mess even larger by their selective release of this video, by the statements of the Ferguson police chief.
The toxicology report.
And that independent autopsy. You know, in any crisis, the crisis managers will tell you, tell it first, tell it fast, and they have ignored that advice. And it's mystifying to me at this late date in the 21st century that they haven't figured out when you're in the middle of a crisis, don't make it worse by, you know, stonewalling and by damming up things.
Let me just throw something out, and then I do want to get Byron Taw to join our conversation. I was reading, I think it was in the New York Times this morning, about interviews with people who observed the shooting of Michael Brown. And you're getting very disparate, I mean, really contradictory views of people who said that they were eyewitnesses. So my question is, perhaps to you, James Peterson, do you think there will be a truth that people will agree that this is what happened on that terrible night in Ferguson?
Well, I think the community of Ferguson there's going to be a truth that they're going to believe. And what do you expect this community to think about the way that the police force has handled the material and the information. You know, how do they have a 19-page police report about the alleged robbery of the convenience store and there's no incident report of the actual shooting? What are people supposed to conclude from that? You know, it's great to say, yes, maybe there's more to the story, or maybe, you know, will we ever get to a truth? But what are people right now supposed to conclude from the fact that they have not released some of the information? They have selectively released information that seems to try to demonize a young man who is now dead, shot dead by one of their officers, left in the street by their police force for 4 hours in that community. I don't understand how people were supposed to respond to that, other than to think that, listen, this is crazy. There's something wrong here. Why else? You know, without that information being released, very, very difficult to get to any truths, number one, and also very, very difficult to diffuse tensions in that community.
Paul, anything you want to add to that?
I'd say that's absolutely correct. You know, the best remedy for the kinds of feelings that are stirring up in this community is to put out more information to either confirm what they think or at least to give a better picture of what actually happened. And that has not occurred yet.
And that is Paul Farhi, media reporter for The Washington Post, joining us with James Peterson, director of Africana Studies, also associate professor of English at Lehigh University. And joining us now is Byron Taw, reporter for Politico, who was in Ferguson last week, returned on Sunday. And Byron Taw, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome, and you're sort of joining a conversation that's sort of midway. We've been spending about the last half hour talking about the media coverage in Ferguson. You were there last week. What was it like to be in the midst of this very fast-moving story?
So I was there Thursday through Sunday. I returned to Washington, D.C. Sunday afternoon, so I did miss the two most violent nights of the protest, but the two nights I were there that sort of descended into chaos and violence, it was a pretty difficult scene and a difficult situation to cover. It was fast-moving. One of the nights we had pretty good access to the protest zone. We were allowed sort of free rein. The next night the police cordoned us off in a very small area, pretty far away from most of the action, and most of the reporters there that night did obey the police's order to stay in that area. So, you know, the kind of access and the kind of insight we had into the scene was very dependent night by night and dependent on the situation.
And picking up on that, to you, Paul Farhi, the idea of cordoning off reporters who were covering a protest, is that, I know the ACLU went to court last week after two reporters, including one from the Washington Post, were arrested, but the idea of cordoning off protesters, is that legal?
Yeah, I was going to say, I wonder if it's even constitutional. I don't know the legalisms on that. I would also say it's pretty useless because good reporters like Byron are going to go out, going to go around that pen and going to find the story on their own, because you can't see a lot, and when you can't see a lot, there's no point in being there. So it struck me as a way perhaps to corral the press, perhaps to control the press. Maybe it had good intentions. I'm not really sure. But ultimately, it's going to be not an effective way for people to cover the story or for the police to keep the media under control.
And Byron,
I should add that you know, in that cordon, we were repeatedly threatened with arrest, or saying you know, the police told us we were subject to arrest if we were to leave that area. So the threats against reporters trying to get access, trying to get visibility, were quite explicit from the police.
And, I mean, the ACLU did go to court to challenge that. Yes, Byron?
It wasn't me personally, but the ACLU, yes, did file a lawsuit last week. One day later, they reached a settlement with the St. Louis police, the St. Louis County, and the local authorities in Ferguson that media were allowed to film the police, and so was the general public. But the issue here was whether the media had special access to the protest zone after the curfew came into place. Because there was a state of emergency and because nobody was allowed on the street, the question then becomes, are reporters allowed to defy the order, to defy the legal standard that the governor set, that not a single person is allowed out on the streets at night?
To you, James. But, yeah, go ahead, Paul. Sounds like you want to
answer. I was going to say, but this goes back to the information war, if you want to call it a war. The idea of arresting reporters is about the most counterproductive strategy you could possibly employ as a police force, because it turns them into martyrs. And we saw with the arrest of Wes Lowery and Ryan O'Reilly last week that it turns the story into a different kind of narrative, which is now you're cracking down on the information flow, you're cracking down on the constitutional rights of the public to learn about the story. So, you know, in addition to all the other mistakes they made, harassing reporters has got to rank right up there.
Well, to you, James, I mean, does it say that they don't know what they're doing in Ferguson, Missouri?
Some of this, I think, is competence. I do, and that's why I wish we had more access. But the idea that the ACLU had to file a lawsuit in order for reporters to be able to cover a situation that, as we've already said earlier on, is we can't even get all the perspectives that we want already. So some of it's competence and or lack thereof, but some of it's also by design. Whose idea was it to cordon off reporters? To me, that's horrifying. That I know that we can talk sort of calm about it, but in a situation like this, where there's a community that's questioning the tactics of the police, and to see police tactics that are limiting information flows, is scary.
To you, Byron, and you were there, as you said, last week, Thursday, and left on Sunday. Had you ever covered anything like what happened in Ferguson last week?
Certainly not. And, you know, Paul wrote an excellent piece about this in the Post yesterday, that a lot of us had never really covered a situation where the police were out in force like this, where we weren't allowed to visit or to see what was happening and what was unfolding before our very eyes, where there was a sort of military-style police response in the street, and where we were under very strict orders and were being threatened with arrest for simply doing our jobs. It was a novel and completely different situation, especially for a lot of reporters that have never worked as a foreign correspondent or never worked anywhere outside of the United States. It was completely new.
The irony here is that the way that reporters and some of these protesters feel is the way that members of the community of Ferguson have felt for generations. That being under the thumb of the police, being contained and controlled by the police, citizens of Ferguson and citizens across this nation have felt that way in terms of their interface with the police force.
Well, and Paul, picking up on that, and there have been some criticisms that some of these reporters who have been arrested, you know, that they have become the story. And that's one way to look at it. I guess another is sort of what James Peterson was saying there, which is that if reporters are getting arrested, maybe that's a little taste of what it's like if you're African-American living in Ferguson, Missouri.
No, I think it's a great point, and it just illustrates perhaps the frustrations of the community that we're seeing in the streets every night. You know, let's face it, reporters are most interested first in their own hide, and so if it happens to them, you're going to hear about it. They've got bigger microphones than anybody else out there. But nevertheless, it's metaphoric for the larger situation, and so we got a taste of their medicine, and it's not they anymore, it's kind of us as well.
Byron, do you want to add to that?
Sure. I mean, you know, I think there was a lot of criticism from far away about reporters inserting themselves into the story, but reporters really do have to step up and defend their rights against being arrested simply for doing their jobs. We have to become part of the story when we're taken into custody, when we're physically prevented from doing what we were sent there to do, because, you know, we do have louder microphones. We have the ability to draw attention to the situation. We have abilities to object to our treatment in a much flatter way, and it really did call attention to the fact of what the police were doing when Ryan Riley and when Wes Lowery of the Post and Huffington Post respectively were arrested. And so, you know, I think it's a fair point for reporters to make themselves part of the story simply to get access and visibility into the scene and to make sure that we're allowed to cover these events and document them for the world.
Well, let's take a short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about the media coverage of Ferguson, Missouri, what it's been like to cover the media, and some of the conflicts the media has had with law enforcement there. That's Byron Taw, the voice you just heard. He's a reporter for Politico. He was in Ferguson last week. He returned on Sunday. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio, James Peterson, Director of Africana Studies, Associate Professor of English at Lehigh University, and he appears on MSNBC from time to time, or actually a lot of the time, and also with us, Paul Farhi. He's a media reporter, for the Washington Post. host. We got a lot of people that want to join our conversation, and I do want to make sure that happens after this short break. And again, that phone number, 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Dell Music Center proudly supports WHYY and presents jazz artists Al Jarreau and David Sanborn in a double bill concert at the newly renovated Dell Music Center in Fairmount Park. Two of America's noted jazz players, with more than a dozen Grammy Awards between them, will collaborate on Thursday, August 21st at 8 p.m. Concert parking is available. Information at mydelleast.com. The Dell Music Center, where the stars take center stage. The Dell Music Center proudly supports WHYY.
All 552 episodes of The Simpsons will be broadcast in the longest single-series marathon in history, beginning Thursday. On the next Fresh Air, our TV critic David Bianculli has an appreciation and will feature interviews with The Simpsons creator Matt Groening, as well as several cast members,
blah, 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 blah,
and writers. Join us
this afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Michael Brown is dead, another unarmed black teenager. Casualty of what?
You have young males encountering a person who knows that black lives don't matter as much as whites.
What is happening in this country, and do we share the urgency of a problem that apparently could happen in any community in America? Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We are talking about whether the media, and we're talking about broadcast, print, and digital, whether the media has effectively and responsibly informed the public about events in Ferguson and the important issues they raise, very important issues that they raise. Let me get, looks like Charles from South Philadelphia to join us. Hi, Charles. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good. I'm a photojournalist locally, and I have a lot of friends and colleagues who are in Ferguson right now. And I just think that this discussion we're having is kind of missing the point. If you look at the RNC protests, if you look at Occupy, reporters have been under threat in this country for a while. And if you look at the Obama's prosecutions of leakers and journalists, it's ongoing, and it's been a problem. Even yesterday, James Foley being executed. You know, reporters are under threat around the world. But looking at Ferguson as some sort of affront to media, I think misses the point. There's a daily affront going on to African Americans around our country, and that's really what Ferguson's about. So looking, I agree with all the points that you guys have been making about how the media, if we're being attacked, then imagine what's happening when the cameras aren't there, what's happening to the people who live in Ferguson. But I just think that we should be talking about, you know, why so many young African-American men are being shot to death and not why reporters are being arrested during their job, because this is nothing new. If you go to protests, I've been arrested at protests before for doing my job. It's a very normal risk of being a journalist. And so I think that this program's just kind of missing the point.
Okay, fair enough. I mean, we this is one of many programs, and I'm sure we will continue and carry on the conversation.
Yeah,
did you want to say something, James?
Of course, because I don't know how many times I have to say it. The key issue here is about whether or not the state, or to what extent does the state value black life. And this, I've tried to say that multiple times because I think that is the issue. So the caller's right. But the reason why media coverage of Ferguson plays a role in that is because with media attention, we're going to help to figure out some of the answers to that key question. And without media coverage and media attention of what's going on in Ferguson, unfortunately, Michael Brown might just be another nameless, faceless, young black male who's killed by the police.
Well, picking up on that, let me go to you, Paul, and to you, Byron, which is, and I think the media has sometimes attention deficit disorder. Something happens somewhere else in the world, and Ferguson, Missouri, will be forgotten. I mean, I guess the question is, what is it the responsibility of the media to keep attention on some of these issues we've been talking about, Paul?
The media does keep attention on these issues. You know, no story is in a vacuum. How many times have we raised the Trayvon Martin story in the context of Michael Brown? How many times has Rodney King's name come up? Eric Gardner as well. And, you know, this is a continuing story. There's no one stop and start. It continues and will continue for as long as this is a problem in our society.
Byron, do you want to add to that?
Yeah, no, I also think the story has been co-opted a bit. You know, obviously what's led the news, what's been on the front page, and what's been on cable are these intense images of clashes between the police, some real fantastic photojournalism showing both the rioters and the police response. But at the core of this story is what happened to this young man, Michael Brown. Right. And that's a different story than the what's happened subsequently. Yeah. And, you know, I think that there's pretty good data about the arrests now. A lot of the rioters, a lot of the looters who were arrested are from out of state or from at least from pretty far away in the St. Louis area in some of these cases. And I think the story has moved beyond the original story to a completely different narrative about the violence and about the chaos and about the mayhem, rather than what it originally was, which was a story about the death of a young man at the hands of a police officer and what happened.
Is that because these images are so compelling, Byron?
I think that's correct. I mean, I think that the media often focuses on the shiny object. They focus on what the good visuals are, what the great images are, and images of peaceful demonstrators, the people that come out during the day, that hold vigils, that hold marches, just aren't as compelling and they aren't as interesting as some of the images of violence and the police response. And that's an unfortunate situation, but it's the media that we have.
Anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I mean, the reason why this topic is important to me is because I think we have to be critical of the media and how the media is covering it. Like I said earlier in the show, too much focus on law enforcement and too much focus on their perspective of this story, I think, obscures what some of the central issues are. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't be covering it, we shouldn't be talking about it. We can do more than one thing at a time. My sense is that part of the reason why the so-called rioting and the skirmishes are more compelling is because we haven't really answered that deep question, which is, do we value black life in the same way that we value human life? You know, if it's so, you know, just again, change the race of the people involved, if that helps you better to understand this. But as someone who has grown up and experienced police harassment, seen police brutality and experienced it directly, you know, this is something I want all Americans to understand, that we actually, there are people in your community who live in fear of the police, and they do so as justifiable. So yes, that's the story, but the fact that people are compelled to think about and talk about other things is also indicative of what the challenge of the story is.
Charles, thanks for the call. Let me get Clarence from South Jersey to join our conversation. Hi, Clarence. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning.
Good to be on.
Sure.
Hi. Let me preface this. Say this right now. I am a 23 Army veteran. I'm also a black Army officer. I have been stopped and frisked and all the good stuff that New York City has to offer, you know, and had to endure it, quote unquote.
Well,
I had an uncle who was shot and killed by the NYPD because he was the only one who didn't run when the cops pulled up on the block.
Wow.
One of the things, though, that we're missing is that when these stories happen, it's a quick blurb because the press does move on to the next one. Right. But what we also miss is when we only couch the argument in terms of a value of black life, we lose half of the population. And that is what we don't want to do. I mean, we as citizens, not just black people or white people, or members of the press and the media, when we only couch it in that, we lose half of the population because people turn off as if then this is the same cry
That's
we've heard
awful.
Before.
You're saying, you know, that white people don't care about this?
No, I'm not saying why people don't care about it, but it starts to alienate people if that is the only cry they hear. You know, when the media looks at it and the effects of heavy-handed police tactics, look back at the story of the young white guy who, you know, after being handcuffed, was set upon by the police dog, and it'll go, and that brings back into the rest of the population. Say, hey, you know, if this happens to somebody like me, it happened to Michael Brown and somebody who looks like me, sounds like me, talks like me, then yes, maybe we as a population across the country need to look at the heavy-handed police tactics that is happening over and over and over again. We don't want to alienate people because the entire population is what it's going to take to force the change from heavy-handed police tactics.
Well, Clarence, let me give James Peterson a chance to respond. I like one here.
If people are alienated by me saying that the question of the value of black life is central to the murder of Michael Brown in a summer where we've lost Eric Garner, where we've lost countless other nameless other black and brown men and women, boys and girls, at the hands of police, at the hands of these so-called vigilantes. If people are alienated by me simply saying black life, then the problem is far worse than what we can see. I'm not trying to exclude folks joke by saying this, but look at the data. Look at the statistics. It's black and brown children who are dying at the hands of police in these kinds of instances. The data bears it out. That's the facts. And the question is, do we as a society, do we as a community, does our police force, does our criminal justice system, do they value the lives of young people of color?
Clarence, I appreciate the comments. Byron, anything you want to respond to either what James said or what Clarence said?
Well, you know, I think it's an interesting question. I do think that there is a widespread interest in this situation across the political spectrum. We've seen Republicans and Democrats, you know, of all races and creeds and colors, speak out against the issues of police militarization, of the treatment of, you know, young men, especially young black men, by the police forces. So I do think this is a big story. It's a story that's dominated headlines. It's not confined to, you know, one segment of the press or one specialty area of the press. This is a big national story that's dominated front pages and been on cable 24/7. And I think it speaks to the changing media environment and the way that some of these you know, incidents get covered, that they can become big national news, that they can become moments for change and reevaluation, you know, how, and it remains to be seen how the political system will respond to it. But it's certainly an interesting story that's really, you know, really captured the attention of the country.
Paul, I thought it was interesting that Rand Paul came out very, very critical, I mean, much more critical, frankly, than the president of what was going on in Ferguson. So it covers an interesting political spectrum, it seems to me.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think conservatives are as much concerned about just one aspect of the story, the militarization of the police as a threat to the public's liberty, as liberals are. And so that unites all of us. And look, we are Democrats with a small d. We do believe in the ability of government to guarantee and protect the rights of the population. And when they are not, it is a threat to democracy, which is kind of what's going on here in a slow motion basis. But let me just want to address one thing about the media coverage.
Sure.
The criticism that we move on from the story is true, but it's true in every story. There is no story that captures consistently the media's attention for any grand length of time, for any, you know, extended length of time. We're always moving on. And by the way, the media is not really a the, it's an A.
Right.
You know, there are many media, and these days there are lots of sources of information. So to say that there is some monolithic thing called the media is kind of a misnomer. Mm-hmm. It misunderstands the complexity of the way information goes from one source to another.
Yeah, fair enough. And picking up on that to you, Byron, and we haven't really talked about the Twitterverse, I guess, as it's called, but certainly the role that has played in telling this story. Can you speak to that?
Sure. You know, I think there were national media outlets on the ground from the beginning. There were reporters from the Washington Post, the LA Times, the New York Times, who saw this as an important story and went very early on. But it was the arrest of those two reporters, as I said, Wes Lowery and Ryan Riley, that really did make this blow up on both social media and made it a front page 24-hour cable news story. And, you know, there's pretty good data from Twitter itself and from, you know, sources that measure Twitter analytics that really do show that when those two reporters were arrested, that was when the world, that was when the social media universe started paying close attention. And, you know, I think that's commentary on on the way that the you know, media and the news cycle operates. But, you know, that's sort of how it is.
Yeah, I'm always on Twitter for information, and I think
you've been on Twitter the whole time. But
I have
that's
been
okay.
Because sometimes things break on Twitter before they break on news, and you know, I'm following Lowery not in print. I'm following him on Twitter, and I think somehow the structure of Twitter, the pacing of it, the shortness of it, and the amount of people that are on it make it probably the social media platform of choice for news reporting. Not to say that Instagram and Facebook aren't good, and you've seen some coverage there, but the Twitter is where it's at when it comes to covering these kinds of things, because there's so many people for you to follow, and the way that they set it up, they can connect you to people who are putting out the kind of information that you want to have access to. And so it's an important use of social media. I mean, it's not a toy. It's a great tool for covering these kinds of events.
Paul, do you agree with that?
Absolutely. I think there's no journalist left in America who isn't on Twitter and doesn't follow it for exactly the reason that James is describing.
Let me get Howard from Chestnut Hill to join our conversation. Hi, Howard. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. I love your show
and your guests.
This is Howard Stevenson from Penn.
Hi, Howard.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you doing?
Great. I actually have been so happy to hear that your guests talk about trauma, black life, because I think in some respect, and watching the news is not simply a sort of objective medium. And so there are times in which the question is, how come media consistently doesn't address the issue of why black life matters? And some people, I think, view this larger media, regardless of its type, as a place where you expect to get competence. And you don't get that around the black life question. Mm. And that even if you're a good reporter, if a good educator, the fear that many of us have is that we expect you to bring the news as it pertains to my fears. And for the focus on police, the fears that are addressed around, are people going to be violent in a community that might harm me and my property? Whereas the black life question addresses people's fears around, is my child going to get shot? Is my little boy going to be in danger simply by walking the streets? And that's where you say, even good reporters who don't have the competence to deal with the black life question, it's not simply having an opinion or asking questions. You want them to be dealing with their own unconscious and conscious racial bias as to why people are so afraid to address that question. Even the earlier caller was trying to say, let's minimize our focus on black life. And I love Dr. Peterson's response. But that is part of the core problem of competence, that when we are outraged, it's because no one's addressing my fear about my son, who is like Michael Brown. I have a Michael Brown. And when the focus is on the police and not really the children in these sort of scenarios or how we might think of it, that's a level of incompetence that must be addressed. And then we understand that the repeated expression of that incompetence is traumatized.
I hear you.
We traumatize every time we hear that somebody doesn't get the black lives question right.
I hear you.
That's a long-winded way.
No. Yeah. It's perfectly fine. I should say to our listeners and to our other guests that Howard Stevenson, a psychologist here in Philadelphia, and has been a guest on Radio Times a number of times. And I guess, James, just because you're sitting across from me, just a quick response. We're nearly out of time here.
I mean, I think it's complicated for people to understand. But the professor really just clarified it. I have a son. And when I see this, we can talk about all these issues, media, free speech, militarization of police, all this. What I'm thinking is can my son walk freely in this country? Can he walk to school? Can he walk to the store to pick up something to drink and some chips? Can he walk in the street with his friend? Those are the questions that are unanswered here. And the trauma of the community of Ferguson is not going to be settled until we get some of those answers.
Well, James Peterson, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times. And to you, Howard Stevenson, thanks for calling into the show. Byron Tao, thank you for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. And Paul Farhi, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Marty.
You're welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including download a podcast of the show. You can also check us out on Facebook and check us out on Twitter as well. And if you want to get our weekly newsletter, you can sign up for that as well. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times. The show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.